I think they should use the word legal. Legal votes. They're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
The president can sue a ham sandwich. He can send 1,000 lawyers.
We have a lot of information coming and litigation that you'll see.
No collusion. There's no collusion after all of that, which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
Winning is easy. Losing is never easy. Not for me, it's not.
Come on, don't be ridiculous. Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
This is Ken White, and you're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues and the colorful cast of characters who litigate them. Josh Barrow, your redoubtable host, is on a well-deserved vacation, and as co-host, I'm left with, as Emperor Palpatine would say, unlimited power. I'm a criminal defense attorney, a former federal prosecutor, and an author of The Popat Report, a legal newsletter on Substack. So for the last couple of weeks, most of the legal news about President Trump has been electoral, about the litigation that he and others have brought in a so far unsuccessful effort to question the result of the election. There's been a whole lot of media heat, but not much legal light. So to fix that, I'm very pleased that we're joined today by a special guest, Professor and Vice Dean Franita Tolson of USC's Gould School of Law. Dean Tolson is an expert on election law and constitutional law and has written about the Elections Clause and gerrymandering and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. She appears on CNN as an election law analyst, and she's the co-host of the podcast Free and Fair with Franita and Foley. It's all about election law, security, and integrity issues. Franita, hi. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
So the Trump administration and the Republican Party and the media have all been asking me to pay a lot of attention the last couple of weeks to a series of lawsuits attacking the election results. So I've been paying that attention, but it seems like they've lost about 24 out of 25 cases. Franita, did I get played here?
Actually, I'm not sure. Maybe we all got played. So the lawsuits have, of course, been in states where that are key to President-elect Biden's victory. They are alleging a wide range of claims, ballot irregularities, fraud, various poll worker errors. You know, it's basically the same lawsuit over and over again. And initially, it felt par for the course, given the president and sort of his claims that he makes on social media and such. But I do have larger concerns that make me think that maybe we were not wrong to pay attention. So we need to make a distinction between the legal case and the political case. The legal case, as you mentioned, Ken, is very weak. Courts have been very aggressive in throwing out these claims, particularly since they are evidence-free. But part of this is it sort of feeds into this larger narrative about the election being stolen. So the everyday Americans aren't reading legal pleadings, right? So they don't know how thin these claims are. They may have no sense of what's really at stake in these disputes. And so bringing all of these lawsuits, creates this smoke that suggests that maybe there's some there, when in fact that there's not. And so I do think that regular Americans, particularly those who support the president, look at the lawsuits as evidence that something is going on, right? So it feeds into the political narrative, even if it doesn't feed into the legal narrative. And you do have to wonder if the media doesn't cover it, then what fills that vacuum, right? And what fills that vacuum is arguably the president's claims, his falsehoods, and so on. And so I don't think the media really had a choice but to cover the lawsuits and to illustrate the point over and over again that there's no there.
Well, and to the extent the media is doing what it should there, is it working? I mean, you see statistics that at least among Republicans, confidence in the outcome of the election has absolutely plummeted. So if, and I take your point that we need to cover the rule of law so that just nonsense doesn't fill the void instead, is that tactic working?
It depends on what we mean by working, right? If, you know, it's about convincing the 70 million Americans that voted for President Trump about the truth of this election, then maybe it's not working. But if it's about being a neutral arbiter of what's actually happening with these lawsuits and what's happening with this election, then maybe that's all you can do. All you can really do is go out there and report what's going on and how things are unfolding. And you can't really concern yourself about people who have a vested interest in not understanding those facts. And that's been true for 4 years, right? And for the last 4 years, I think the media has had to go out there and present the world as it appears to at least some segments of the population, with the understanding that all segments are not going to buy in. And so, you know, maybe it's it's frustrating for sure, especially for those of us who are election law experts and we are very well versed in the legal claims and know that they have very little merit, trying to convince huge proportions of the population of that fact and basically failing. But I feel like we have an obligation to do it.
Well, that sounds very familiar as someone who's been talking about legal issues during the last couple of years of the Trump administration. But I'm in the position of not being someone who's an election law expert, really sometimes feeling like I don't completely get what's going on and having to rely on the media. So just to take an example, yesterday there was some relatively brief drama when the County Board of Canvassers in Wayne County, Michigan, failed to certify the election results there, implying that they wouldn't, splitting 2-2 Republicans to Democrats. Now, later on, after initially refusing to certify the election results, they changed their mind and did certify them. But the president retweeted something about it. It was a big drama. What was actually going on there, and is it important?
So, admittedly, my initial reaction to seeing what was happening in Wayne County with the Board of Canvassers was, you know, honestly, holy shit. Like, what's happening? But I'm just being honest. That was my reaction. I'm like, oh my God, like, you know, so what does this mean? And so, you know, even as an election law person, I had to take a step back and say, okay, so how does this fit in the grand scheme of things? How does this fit with the president's narrative? What happens next? And so, you know, if the Wayne County Board would have stayed deadlocked, it would have went to the State Board of Canvassers, who also a partisan body, right? So they could conceivably deadlock as well. But the Michigan governor has authority to remove members of these boards. And so that in itself, you know, once I realized that and sort of thought about it, I'm like, okay, so this is another Hail Mary. How can we change the election outcome result? How can we change the narrative attempt by the Trump campaign to make a difference in what's happening, to delay the inevitable in a sense? And it would have been a delay. But at the end of the day, he probably would have ended up in the same position. And ultimately, I think the goal is to throw the election to the House. I was reading some reporting today, which seemed to indicate that Rudy Giuliani thought that this was the best chance for success. But it's just incredibly unlikely to happen. And even if you have allies who are well-placed, for example, the two Republican members of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers, even then, it is very difficult for all of the things that need to go wrong in order for this election outcome to change. And so once I put it in broader perspective, I realized that no matter what, Michigan is, you know, going to Joe Biden. It's staying in his column.
And it ultimately didn't work. They changed their mind, possibly because of huge public pressure to certify.
Right. You know, voters are getting upset, right? Voters are starting to behave much like the courts have behaved in the last 10 days, right? Courts have not been willing to credit these allegations without evidence. And the Trump campaign has failed to bring forward relevant evidence to indicate that there's some election irregularity or some fraud that affected the outcome of the election in these states. And I think voters are starting to get tired of all of these efforts to change the outcome, right? People want to move on. And so I do think you're seeing some exhaustion here. And I don't think it's limited to Democrats. I think that Republicans are starting to put some pressure on people on their side to accept that election outcome.
Now, I think we have to be a little fair here to the Trump campaign and the Trump administration that not every lawsuit we've seen is actually by them, right? Some of them are by conservative interest groups and Republican groups and intermeddlers and that type of thing. Have you seen a big difference in aggressiveness or the quality of the arguments between the lawsuits filed explicitly on behalf of the Trump campaign and the ones sort of done by outside interlopers?
Not really. Although I want to be clear about one thing, and I'll talk about that in a second. So I do think that for the most part, the litigation has focused on these broad, unsupported claims, regardless if they're brought by the Trump campaign or by other Republican entities that are aligned with the campaign. But that being said, I do think there are some arguments that have been brought in litigation that may not change the outcome of this particular election, but they are arguments that we are going to have to contend with in the future. So one argument in particular that gives me pause is this notion about the authority of state legislatures to set the election rules. This was given a lot of attention in the context of the Pennsylvania litigation, where for your listeners, the challenge was to the ballot receipt deadlines, which had been extended by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. There was an argument that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had unduly intruded on the authority of the state legislature to set the election rules, because the Constitution delegates to state legislatures the power to set the manner of appointing electors. And so there's this doctrine, the independent state legislature doctrine, which says that the state legislature's authority is exclusive, which means that the state legislature acts independent of the state constitution and independent of any other organs of state of the state. So the state Supreme Court also cannot constrain the state legislature in this matter. Currently, there are four Supreme Court justices who seem very open to this argument. Right. So even if and the ballots that were at issue in the Pennsylvania case had, you know, they were not included in the vote totals. And so they have no bearing on the outcome here. They don't number enough to change the outcome. But I do think this is an argument that we are going to have to confront in elections going forward. So while the actual cases won't change the outcome, there are some arguments that were being made that I think we will have to confront.
Well, and the practical impact of those might be most felt in emergency situations like the ones we're seeing in the pandemic, right? When some court attempts to adjust things to address some sort of problem, then the argument is going to be the court can't do that. If a polling place was wrongfully shut down or late opening or had equipment failures, a court doesn't have the power to ask it to stay open another hour under this theory, because only the legislature can do that. Is that right?
Yes. So the implications of this is actually pretty far reaching. The U.S. Supreme Court had already been reluctant to let federal district courts adopt remedies that were effectively last-minute changes to the election rules. So, Ken, you're right. This notion that federal courts, their hands are tied in their ability to step in and address last-minute election emergencies. But this doctrine is of particular relevance to state courts as well, right? So the doctrine that confines the authority of federal courts applies to federal courts. This doctrine is broader in a sense that it will constrain the ability of state courts to make last minute changes to elections for the presidency and elections for members of Congress in order to address burdens that voters may experience, for example, COVID related issues that have come up in both the primaries and the general election. So it's really important. In my view, it's very dangerous. Because there is a right to vote, supposedly, that should have some that should have some precedence here. But the Supreme Court doesn't seem to be too concerned about that. And they seem primarily concerned about the authority of state legislatures and the state more generally to regulate the election.
Well, because practically, if there's a right to vote, but courts are constrained, whether they're state or federal, from taking steps to enforce that right or correcting things that have been done to interfere with that right, then the right is effectively meaningless.
Exactly. And that is something that has troubled me, especially as in the last few years, like even beyond the current election season, you see the Supreme Court moving away from robust protections of the right to vote and being more focused on the power of the states to set rules concerning election administration and to govern their elections, and being very deferential to that authority in a way that I don't think the Constitution requires. But the court itself is the entity that has inferred a right to vote within the context of the 14th Amendment, and now they seem reluctant to enforce it. And this is in addition to the fact that 49 out of 50 state constitutions have an explicit right to vote in their state constitutions. And so in some ways, the right to vote should be doubly protected, but it's not. Everything has sort of given way to concerns about the state's control over elections.
So in the last couple of years, we've seen the United States Supreme Court cut back on the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which I know is one of your subjects. We've seen a lot of rhetoric about the need to defend against voter fraud. We've seen moves towards voter ID rules and laws and things like that, and a lot of back and forth arguing between Republicans and Democrats about that. Have we seen those themes and those issues echoed in these Trump administration election lawsuits? In other words, are these lawsuits playing out that bigger fight in court?
So the bigger fight about sort of post Shelby County. So Shelby County versus Holder, for your listeners, is a Supreme Court decision that invalidated a portion of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that required certain jurisdictions to pre-clear changes to their election laws with the federal government before those changes could go into effect. And these are jurisdictions that had horrible records on voting rights and racial discrimination in voting. And so if I understand your question correctly, the question is, to what extent has the Trump campaign picked on this up on this theme of sort of emphasizing state sovereignty to the detriment of the right to vote? Is that
well, not just that, and I see what you're saying there, but also just, you know, the move towards voter ID laws seems to be premised in the idea that there's this huge surge of voter fraud, despite the fact that there's absolutely no evidence to support that. Let's be clear, but we're hearing a lot of the same arguments, it seems to me, in these lawsuits that we heard over the last few years in support of voter ID laws and in support of the Supreme Court's cutback of the Voting Rights Act and so forth.
Right, right. So interestingly enough, you have to question the extent to which the Supreme Court's case law invites the very thing that's happening. In the context of voter ID laws, the court has upheld voter ID laws based on the justification that it prevents fraud or the appearance of fraud. It is that appearance of fraud language that invites states to justify their voter ID laws without any evidence, right? It's just enough to assert that fraud might exist. To some extent, the Supreme Court has invited the very arguments that we're seeing in court now with the Trump campaign, this idea that there's widespread fraud that has should call the election into question, and the fact that the Trump campaign is making these assertions without evidence. But the problem is that given the stakes, lower courts are not willing to accept that broad claim without evidence, right? They're not willing to overturn the election results without evidence. This is far different than trying to justify a regulation that gives voters, at least in the view of some states, some sense that the election is secure, that people who are casting ballots are actually who they are. When we're talking about counting votes, states have a number of procedures in place to verify that voters are who they are, right? And so it's not enough to just assert that fraud exists without some evidence of actual fraud. Now, don't get me wrong, Ken. Even in the context of voter ID laws, I think broad assertions of fraud without any evidence of fraud is incredibly problematic, right? But to me, the argument that people have to believe the system is working, therefore these restrictions help contribute to that belief, that is firmer ground to stand on than what the Trump campaign is currently doing in making these assertions about widespread fraud and the fact that that should affect the votes that count. Right. They're talking about disenfranchising large amounts of people based on a claim that is unsupported by evidence. And that is different in kind and a huge problem.
I'm speaking with Vice Dean and Professor Franita Tolson of USC's Gould School of Law. When we come back, we'll talk more about the ongoing saga of lawsuits attacking election results. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Ken White, and I'm back with Franita Tolson of USC's Gould School of Law and All the President's Lawyers. Franita, yesterday I spent a regrettable portion of my day listening to a court hearing in Pennsylvania as Rudy Giuliani appeared in court for the first time in, as far as I can tell, 28 years, in a hearing before a federal judge in Pennsylvania representing the Trump campaign. In an argument that the results there should be thrown out or not certified because of problems with observation of the votes. And I cannot say that it went well for Rudy Giuliani. It really doesn't seem like the Trump people, in terms of lawyers, are generally putting in their starting players. Sometimes it seems more like they're putting in the guy who had to quit from being the mascot because the outfit was itchy. Is this a thing? Is it unusual that you have attorneys of the sort that we see here taking the forefront in litigating big election claims?
Well, Ken, I will say that I think whether or not yesterday went well depends on the level of scrutiny you're applying to the proceedings. Was it normal scrutiny or, right, like, what?
All 10 of us who understood that joke loved it, Franita.
Thank you. So I will say that election law scholars kind of predicted this. you know, that yesterday would be a disaster. You had this 11th hour change in the lineup, in part because I think some of the Trump campaign's lawyers, or should I say former lawyers, are starting to cave to the pressure, the public pressure of, you know, this perception that they're involved in litigation that can undermine our democracy. And so it's not surprising that one, Rudy Giuliani would be that person who decides to come to the forefront. And two, that it's a disaster that he did so, right? He's not an election law person. Who knows last time he practiced law? I mean, there was some chatter that he wasn't even a member of the bar in good standing. And so, you know, it isn't surprising that the hearing turned into a spectacle, but I think that it is surprising as a general matter for someone who is not well-versed in election law issues to try to take the lead on a case that has substantial implications. You know, but what we witnessed was the downside of Rudy Giuliani deciding to insert himself into this process, right? He made all these wild allegations about fraud that were not even in the complaint. He wasn't clear about the governing legal standard, which is, you know, my joke. And the claim itself was questionable, right? So the claim before the court is actually very, very narrow. And it has to do with counties in Pennsylvania that allow voters to fix errors in their ballot. And the fact that other counties did not. And so the question was whether or not this differential treatment violated the Equal Protection Clause. Spoiler, it doesn't. In part because that would call into question pretty much every election system in this country where voters are treated differently. Bush versus Gore, which dealt with a somewhat similar issue of voters being treated differently, does not stand for the proposition that counties within a state cannot choose to treat voters differently, which they do with different voting technologies, with different rules, with, you know, that would basically change the nature of our entire election system if a court was to accept this claim. So he's already on very thin ice with the type of claim that is before the court. And then he just completely turned the proceedings into a spectacle. But not surprising, given this litigation.
I think some of our listeners probably assume that we're exaggerating for a comedic or political effect, but it's really difficult to overemphasize how badly it went with him. I mean, as your joke referenced, the judge was asking him about what standard review the judge should apply to the equal protection claim. In other words, how hard does the government have to try to justify treating different people differently? Is it something called strict scrutiny, which is a very tough burden for the government to carry, or something called a rational basis? And it was just completely clear that Giuliani had no idea what he was talking about and no grasp of the relevant constitutional standards and issues that are at the heart of the claim that he's arguing. It was really just one of the most astounding in-court spectacles I've ever observed. And we hear he wants $20,000 a day for it, which I guess in some places might be the going rate for ritual public humiliation, but seems a little rich. And I'm having a hard time getting by that these cases are so big, so crucial, that nominally have some impact on the outcome of the presidency, and the people they're sending in across the country, with a few exceptions, really don't seem to be at all up to the task. And I mean, the inference I'm taking from it is that they know these claims are bogus, that it is just for theater and for conveying to their base that this election is illegitimate. And so it doesn't matter whether they know what a rational basis test is, because the people they're talking to don't know what it is.
Exactly. And to be fair, and okay, it's not fair. I'm definitely piling on. I teach this to my first years. Right. So not that I expect Rudy to remember the first year of law school, but it was just so basic that, you know, I think it was astounding for most people who have been to law school to realize that he had no idea what was happening. But to take your broader point, the people who they're talking to don't care about that. This is not about the legal claims. This is not about the legal cases. That's why it doesn't matter who defends these claims for the president. What's more important, I think, is the political message. Because, Kim, would your opinion change about what's happening if you thought about it like, oh, you know, maybe Trump is going to run for president again in 2024? Because when I started to think about it that way, some of what's happening made a lot more sense to me. right? The fact that he's going through all of this, he's going through all of this trouble to appeal to his base, right? To you know, show things about himself that they appreciate, right? He has this perception among his base of being very tough, of not standing down. And so a lot of the litigation feeds into that broader narrative. And if he's going to gear up for another run, to me, it makes perfect sense. It doesn't matter if the legal claims are bogus. What matters is that he's fighting, and they like that about him.
So historically, is that a thing? I mean, we've talked on this show, we talk a lot about performative litigation, right? Litigation that sends a message to the base, as opposed to having any actual genuine legal merit or serious legal issues. Historically, have election challenges been used for this purpose, more as theater for the base than attempts to actually make a good argument to overturn an election or change a rule?
So I don't know if it's been used for that purpose exactly, but I do think that there are often meritless election law claims brought, or I shouldn't say meritless. We'll put it this way: claims, litigation that is brought that won't change the outcome. And so one might say Jill Stein's attempt in 2016 to get recounts in three states was a blank mission, right? That it wasn't likely to change the outcome, but she did it. But she was, I don't think there was a base she was appealing to in trying to do that necessarily. So, you know, I think election law, like many other areas, is an area where you can have meritless lawsuits. But this particular type of lawsuit designed to appeal to a base, I don't know if we've seen that.
So I don't think we can ignore the fundraising element here. I mean, there's been a lot of fundraising by the Trump campaign and related entities that points to this litigation and needing money for it. But when you look at the fine print, as many outlets have pointed out, the lion's share of the money goes to retire Trump campaign debt or to fund PACs to do future political activities.
Yes, I think that that's probably the larger goal to raise money off of this. But that doesn't, so both can be true, right? He could be trying to position himself as the leader of the party for the foreseeable future, which is why he's, you know, seeing this through so aggressively. But he also could be trying to raise money in order to retire his campaign debt. One thing that sort of flagged for me that he has these dual motivations is the fact that he's going to pay $8 million, according to the reports that I've read, to have a recount done in Wisconsin. So the campaign has to pay for that. And he's willing to pay that cost, even though a recount is unlikely to shift as many ballots as needed in order for him to be declared the victor, which says that his level of commitment is it's worrying, but he is committed. He is committed to this narrative. He is committed to seeing this through.
So one thing I've been noticing is that a lot of this litigation hinges on standing. And standing for our listeners is something we talked about before. It's the idea of who has the right to come into federal or state court and bring this claim? And can the court hear it? Does this person raise an actual case or controversy as to themselves that a court has a right to listen to? Has that traditionally been one of the big issues in election law litigation? Is that something that usually comes up?
Yeah, so there are standing issues that routinely come up in this area when you think about who was actually harmed by certain types of behavior. So to give you an example from the current Trump lawsuits, a court in Pennsylvania recently dismissed part of a case on standing grounds. And it wasn't, I don't think the Trump campaign was directly involved. I think it involved a person who had run for Congress and a few voters on the grounds that the claim that, and so the claim was that the ordinary rules that election officials applied in running the election intruded on the authority of the state legislature, right? So it came back to this state, independent state legislature doctrine that I talked about earlier in the show. In reality, that's something for the state legislature to complain about. Right. If they feel that their authority has been intruded on, then these individuals don't have standing to complain about this. So it does. It definitely comes up, and it's definitely been an issue even in recent cases.
So the other issue that we're hearing a lot about is timing. So, you know, a lot of these seem to be claims coming up in this litigation, attacking new rules, attacking procedures that were known about before the election. but they're not being complained about until after the election, in some cases a couple of weeks after the election. Has that historically been a thing too? Have people taken a shot at overturning election rules but not bothered to do it until after the voting's done?
Absolutely. So you often see, you know, litigants make claims about things that they should have complained about before the election. And so the doctrine latches should apply to some of these arguments. To give you a current example, there was a claim in one of the lawsuits that different procedures for vote by mail versus in-person voting was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, which, number one, is ridiculous. But even more broadly, this is something that if this was really true, right, if this is something that causing the inequities that the campaign was concerned about, they could have brought this up weeks ago. They basically brought the claim too late. And so, Ken, let me make one related point, because if a court was, you know, hospitable to that type of argument, I can't explain how infuriating that would be to me, because courts have been really aggressive, and the Supreme Court in particular, about preventing federal district courts from adopting any changes that would change the rules of the election too close to the election. So I need some consistency here. Don't allow litigants to succeed on claims that have been brought too late, which essentially is a post-election change to the rules of the election. And so if anything, this is one area where I'm like, okay, yes, latches should apply. The court should aggressively keep litigants from bringing claims late, because we already have to deal with situations in which courts are, their hands are tied with respect to trying to make voting easier for individuals caught in situations that couldn't have been predicted well before the election.
Yeah, to me, I mean, this is like a classic case of latches. This is like, you know, you think your neighbor is prohibited from building a house that's going to block your view, but you wait till they build the house to go to court to try to get it torn down. It seems like the same sort of thing here, that it's bad faith waiting to see how it comes out and only bringing the claims if they wind up being necessary.
But it's part of the broader legal strategy here, right? Let's just see what sticks. And so that's why you see a wide variety of claims, including the fact that most of them don't have any evidence to support the truthfulness of the allegations. And you see attempts made that should have been made before the election, but the fact of the matter is it wasn't relevant then, right? They view this as another attempt to try to make a run at having an argument that could possibly sway a court, and it's just simply not working.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. I've been speaking with Fernita Tolson, professor and vice dean of faculty and academic affairs at USC's Gould School of Law. Fernita, thank you so much for joining me today, and I'm even going to forgive you for beating me to the rational basis joke.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
If you out there have questions about the president's lawyers and his ongoing legal issues, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW, or you can leave us a voicemail at 424-538-8888. This episode of All the President's Lawyers was produced by Rebecca Mooney. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Ken White. Thanks for joining us. And Josh and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.